Nicola Denis is sitting next to me. She's the translator of Eric Vuillard's book, L'Ordre du Jour, Die Tagesordnung, The Agenda. Andreas Retzer wanted to be here. He is the publisher. Mattes and Seitz is the publishing house. Actually, he was supposed to be here with us, but he couldn't make it. So you'll just witness a nice and kind of private talk between Nicola Denis, the translator, and myself. I'm Jens Hilje. I'm a dramaturge. I'm with the Gorky Theatre, and I'm a member of the jury. And that's Frank Halbach. He's also a member of the jury. And he has headsets too. So I will start with the end. He will be the next host. And that's why he is sitting here and listening and looking at us, listening to us and looking at us. Now, Eric Vuillard has written a little book, few pages only, but it's a huge topic. It's about the Nazi regime in Germany and in Europe. It's a small novel and it's a condensed novel. And he's focusing on special scenes and situations and moments. Well, what you know, what you want to know who we are, Channel 4, the German version, Channel 4. Well, actually, if I'm speaking German, you should listen to Channel 4 if you want to listen to me. So there are four moments I would like to focus on. 1938 is the year, the Anschluss of Austria to Nazi Germany and two special moments just before Adolf Hitler is receiving Schuschnigg, the Austrian Chancellor, in the Obersalzberg, and he forces him to accept ministers of the Nazi party in his government. Now, we could read this as a chamber theater play, like Nicola and myself, Hitler and Schuschnigg are sitting in a room, and then the dust of the tanks, the Germans invade Austria, but there is a problem, a technical problem with the tanks. The tanks cannot move on, but Hitler drives by the masses. The people are waiting for Hitler, but they are getting tired and it might fail. Now, the field the writer focuses on is described in the first chapter, happens here in the Reichstag's president's palace in 1933. You might know this building. This is where the Jamaica coalition failed, which is why the building is present once again. Now, at the time, Hermann Göring was the president of the German parliament, the Reichstag, and the building was his residence. And this is where 24 executives of the German industry, Krupp, Rothe, Fund, and others visit Hitler and the president of the German Reichstag and promise money so that the NSDAP can carry out its election campaign. Now we will end with the last chapter of the book, 1944 until 1958 is the time frame. It's about Alfred Krupp after the Nazi period. This is Gustav Krupp, it's not Alfred Krupp, but still a member of the Krupp family. In 1958, we see Alfred Krupp, the son and inheritor. But I would like to ask Nicola first to read from her wonderful translation of L'Ordre du Jour, and we will talk about the special challenges of the translation, and we will talk about the reception of the book in France and in Germany. Well, thank you. Maybe I briefly tell you a bit about Eric Vouillard, who would have loved to be here, but his publishing house, Actes du Sud, is celebrating its 40th anniversary, so he had promised to be there. Now, I will read from the second chapter, 20th February 1933. And since we will talk about the German book, I will read the German text. I will start with the German version. I will have to read the French version myself since the author is not here.
Türen knirscht das Parkett. Wortgeplänkel im Vorzimmer. Die 24 Echsen richten sich auf ihren Hinterfüßen auf. Kerzengerade. Chalmer Schacht muss kurz schlucken. Gustav klemmt sein Monokel fest. Hinter den Türflügeln hört man gedämpfte Stimmen, dann ein Pfeifen. Endlich betritt der Reichstagspräsident den Raum, Hermann Göring. Und das, es überrascht uns nicht im geringsten, ist im Grunde ein ganz banales Ereignis. Routine. Im Geschäftsleben sind Partisanenkämpfe nicht der Rede wert. Politiker und Industrielle sind gewohnt, miteinander umzugehen. Göring macht seine Hausherrenrunde, hat für jeden ein persönliches Wort und schüttelt wohlmeinend sämtliche Hände. Doch der Reichstagspräsident ist nicht nur zu ihrer Begrüßung gekommen. Er nuschelt ein paar Willkommensworte und kommt umgehend auf die baldigen Wahlen am 5. März zu sprechen. Die 24 Sphinxe lauschen aufmerksam. Der in Aussicht stehende Wahlkampf sei entscheidend, erklärt der Reichstagspräsident. Mit der Instabilität des Regimes müsse nun endlich Schluss sein. Die Wirtschaftstätigkeit verlange Umsicht und Entschlossenheit. Die 24 Herren nicken andächtig mit dem Kopf. Die elektrischen Kerzen des Kronleuchters flackern, die große auf die Decke gemalte Sonne leuchtet kräftiger als vorhin. Und falls die Nazi-Partei die Mehrheit erringe, fährt Göring fort, seien diese Wahlen die letzten für die nächsten 10 Jahre. Ja, setzt er lachend hinzu, für die nächsten 100. Eine zustimmende Regung geht durch die Zuhörerschaft. Im selben Moment hört man Türgeräusche. Endlich betritt der neue Kanzler den Salon. Diejenigen, die ihm noch nie begegnet sind, harren neugierig auf seinen Anblick. Hitler lächelt, wirkt entspannt, überhaupt nicht, wie man es sich vorstellt, leutselig, ja geradezu liebenswürdig. Sehr viel liebenswürdiger als gedacht. Er hat für jeden ein Wort des Dankes, einen energischen Händedruck. Als die Begrüßungen absolviert sind, nehmen alle wieder in ihren behaglichen Sesseln Platz. Krupp sitzt in der ersten Reihe und pickt mit einem nervösen Finger in seinem winzigen Schnurrbart. Direkt hinter ihm schlagen zwei Direktoren der IG Farben, aber auch von Fink, Quandt und einige andere, gewichtig die Beine übereinander. Man hört ein kehliges Husten, das kaum vernehmliche Klicken einer Stiftkappe. Stille. Sie hören zu. Die wesentliche Aussage lässt sich wie folgt zusammenfassen. Es gelte, mit einem schwachen Regime Schluss zu machen, die kommunistische Bedrohung abzuwehren, die Gewerkschaften abzuschaffen und jedem Chef zu erlauben, in seinem Unternehmen ein Führer zu sein. Die Rede dauert eine halbe Stunde. Als Hitler fertig ist, steht Gustav auf, tritt einen Schritt vor und dankt ihm im Namen aller anwesenden Gäste, endlich die politische Situation geklärt zu haben. Der Kanzler dreht noch eine kurze Runde und bricht wieder auf. Man beglückwünscht ihn, zeigt sich zuvorkommend. Die alten Industriellen wirken erleichtert. Sobald er gegangen ist, ergreift Göring das Wort, wiederholt nachdrücklich ein paar Ideen und kommt erneut auf die Wahlen vom 5. März zu sprechen. Es sei eine einmalige Gelegenheit, der bisherigen Sackgasse zu entkommen. Doch um einen Wahlkampf zu führen, brauche man Geld. Die Nazi-Partei habe jedoch keinen müden Groschen mehr und der Wahlkampf rücke näher. In diesem Augenblick erhebt sich Hjalmar Schacht, lächelt in die Versammlung und ruft: Und nun, meine Herren, an die Kasse. Cet invite, certes un peu cavalière, n'avait rien de bien nouveau pour ces hommes. Ils étaient coutumiers des pots de vin et des dessous de table. La corruption est un poste incompressible du budget des grandes entreprises. Cela porte plusieurs noms: lobbying, étrenne, financement de partis. La majorité des invités versa donc aussitôt quelques centaines de milliers de marques. Gustav Krupp fit don d'un million, Georg von Schnitzler de 400 000, et l'on récolta ainsi une somme rondelette. Cette réunion du 20 février 1933, dans laquelle on pourrait voir un moment unique de l'histoire patronale, une compromission inouïe avec les nazis, n'est rien d'autre pour les Krupp, les Opel, les Siemens, qu'un épisode assez ordinaire de la vie des affaires, une banale levée de fonds. Tous survivront au régime et financeront à l'avenir bien des partis à proportion de leurs performances. Mais pour mieux comprendre ce que la réunion du 20 février pour en saisir le fond d'éternité, il faut désormais appeler ces hommes par leur nom. Ce ne sont plus Günther Quandt, Wilhelm von Opel, Gustav Krupp, August von Finck qui sont là cette fin d'après-midi, le 20 février 1933, dans le palais du président du Reichstag. Ce sont d'autres noms qu'il faut dire. Car Günther Quandt est un cryptonyme. Il dissimule tout autre chose que le gros bonhomme en train de se poisser les moustaches et qui se tient gentiment à sa place autour de la table d'honneur. Derrière lui, juste derrière lui, se trouve une silhouette autrement imposante. Ombre tutélaire, aussi froide et impénétrable qu'une statue de pierre. Oui, surplombant de toute sa puissance, féroce, anonyme, la figure de Quandt, et lui donnant cette rigidité de masque, mais d'un masque qui collerait au visage mieux que sa propre peau, on devine au-dessus de lui Akkumulatorenfabrik AG, la future Varta que nous connaissons, puisque les personnes morales ont leurs avatars, comme les divinités anciennes prenaient diverses formes et au fil du temps s'agrégeaient d'autres dieux. Tel est donc le nom authentique des Quandt, leur nom de démiurge, puisque lui, Günther, n'est qu'un tout petit tas de chair et d'os, comme vous et moi, et qu'après lui, ses fils et les fils de ses fils s'assiéront sur le trône. Mais le trône, lui, demeure, quand le petit tas de chair et d'os s'aigrit dans la terre. Ainsi, les 24 ne s'appellent ni Schnitzler, ni Witzleben, ni Schmidt, ni Fink, ni Rosterk, ni Heubel, comme l'état civil nous incite à le croire. Ils s'appellent BASF, Bayer, Agfa, Opel, IG Farben, Siemens, Allianz, Telefunken. Sous ces noms, nous les connaissons. Nous les connaissons même très bien. Ils sont là parmi nous, entre nous. Ils sont nos voitures, nos machines à laver, nos produits d'entretien, nos radios réveil, l'assurance de notre maison, la pile de notre montre. Ils sont là, partout, sous forme de choses. Notre quotidien est le leur. Ils nous soignent, nous vêtent, nous éclairent, nous transportent sur les routes du monde, nous bercent. Et les 24 bonhommes présents au palais du président du Reichstag, ce 20 février, ne sont rien d'autre que le mandataire, le clergé de la grande industrie. Ce sont les prêtres de Ptah. Et ils se tiennent là, impassibles, comme 24 machines à calculer aux portes de l'enfer. Reglos verharren sie dort, wie 24 Rechenmaschinen an den Toren zur Hölle.
Einige Wochen später öffnen sich die Tore.
A few weeks later the doors of the gates of the of hell open. Now this is German history, but it's also, of course, including Austria and the Anschluss of Austria and the Nazi dominance. Why this topic? Why has Eric Vuillard decided to write about this topic? Has he always dealt with history? But I mean, from a German perspective, it's an interesting choice, since he's a French writer. Now, he isn't here tonight, so I'm free to say what I want, but maybe I should also mention his books in general. Each book is kind of a brick, i.e. part of a house he is going to build. It's about capitalism, it's about imperialism and colonialism, and he's asking questions. He's challenging lots of notions. Conquistador, about the conquest of the Inca Empire, was his first book. Then Ballade vom Abendland, that's his second book, about World War I, 2014. Congo was written in 2015, about the Berlin Conference, the Congo Conference, 1852, and in 2017, Traurigkeit der Erde, which is about the Indian Wars in the United States, the Indigenous People's Wars, and Buffalo Bill. Well, maybe you could tell us a bit about this book, because this is also a spectacular thing, right? Yeah, right. He focuses on Buffalo Bill. He was really successful and famous with his Wild West show in the United States and in Europe. And then he invited the last Native survivors on stage. They had to perform or to enact their own fate, which is an interesting metaphor, because it shows how history is being exploited and becomes a spectacle, and how you enact dominance and power. Now, I still haven't answered your question, why this topic, why Germany? Now, when we were on a reading journey, he said it's quite nice that this book was published in Germany right now, but he's always writing several books at the same time. And then if he can't write a given book, he turns to another one. Jens doesn't believe me, but what do you think, Jens? Now, this is clearly going back to what you've just read, and I'd call it a scene. It's not a chapter, it's a scene. It's like a theater play. Someone enters the stage and acts and then leaves the stage again. You have the idea of dominance, power, and capitalism, and a control of society, which is clearly a moment Vuillard focuses on. And it's certainly one of the sensitive issues of our times, because we do have the capitalists here, so to speak, the economic powers, men who are the ones who can decide whether they want to support Hitler or not. And they decide to grant him support, because that's what they want to have in order to have their companies flourish. Whereas in real life, you need democracy in order to have powerful companies. I mean, this is also about present times, and I don't want to mention the name of the US president, but there is the idea of an authoritarian government, which works well in a capitalist society. And then there is treason. France has experienced a situation in which, for the first time ever, the Front National was about to enter the presidency. And the question is always, who plays along, who does what? So this is clearly about treason too, which is why I don't quite agree to your explanation, because this is also about what is happening now. And for a writer, it's very important to find the right things to write about. I mean, you carry out a lot of research, and then you need to decide what to write about. That's part of the work of art, which is certainly also due to the fact that he's part of a discourse which is characterized by a certain perception of the world. And maybe France is 10 to 20 years ahead of us, because the Front National has been around for a while. And the question is, how can we turn it to a question once again, also in Germany, in spite of the German history? Yeah, but then he also says that the next book will be about France. The 14 juillet will be the subject matter, 14th of July. But this is not about history only. This is clearly going to be about France today. It's to be published next year, 1789, of course, the 14th of July. That's what he's writing about. Indeed, it's also about giving those a voice who don't have a voice or who don't have a name. And they are the ones who speak in his next novel. Concerning the form, he chose... Now, this is special, right? On the French edition, it says récit, a report. In the German version, you don't have narrative, narration, report. I mean, is there a German translation for the French work récit? And did you talk about it? I mean, yeah, we did. Long. And then the author called me when the first version was available as a PDF, so to speak, and he called me and said, you don't put récit on it. And then I tell you what the publisher would probably say, that they decided to do without récit or narration or report on the cover, because people won't buy it. But it was on the title before, a tale, a narration, a story. So should it be a story? Should it be a report? That's the question. And then they had put it inside, and then they put it on the cover again, but nobody was really happy about having something put on the cover or inside, which would be a récit in the German version. Now, we talked about it earlier today. I think it's quite good that you don't have it on the German cover, because as far as the genre is concerned, the German reception has changed. In the beginning, people were really eager to have a certain genre printed on the book. I mean, people know that this is fiction, this is a rhapsody. There were different descriptions. Some people even said it's non-fiction. Others said, well, can you really go and write a novel, which is a fictionalized novel? Now, without any marker, without any label on the cover, you don't have that discussion anymore. And in the German writing history, things are changing. Die Totengräber would be an example. You might have heard of it, which is also a bit like this, without being that literary, if I may say so. So there is a certain openness today. Well, I think it's a good idea to not put any label on the cover, because German critics would love to say, well, it's not a receipt, it's not a report or narration. So let's talk about the form. I love the interesting, exciting approach, because this is a true mix. It has elements of a narration, it's a bit of an essay, it's poetic, you have different layers or levels of the language, you have different gestures, you have unexpected turns and twists, there is a non-fiction language, there is a poetic language, you have anglicisms, you have very modern word. I guess it was quite difficult to translate the book. So what was the idea you had in mind when working on the different layers or levels of language and forms, and what were the difficulties you encountered? Well, we will talk about the idea of the theater play or the enactment again. Now, there are different characters or figures. And of course, it's always been important to show that this is literature, because Eric Vuillard wants to tell the truth by means of literature, so to speak. And he shows at the same time what literature can do. It might be too much of a virtuosity, so to speak, for some of you, but it's fun. It's real fun. I think it's fun for him to write. It was fun for me to translate, and there are clear definitions or instructions, so to speak. I know when he changes the register, so I need to follow him, and sometimes, of course, I asked him, and of course he wants us to use words which get us back into the time, like the Vater murder, which is a special name for a special type of collar, for example, which at the same time means the killer of your father. And he wants to have this idea of killing one's father sound in the description of the collar. And it's quite nice what you can do with the German language. But then you also have words like groggy. Yeah, he also loves English words. It's the finance language, or the language of the finance world, or the marketing world. And sometimes he puts English words in italics, and then you ask yourself, why does he put them in italics? And sometimes I just decided to find another word just because it better fits the sentence. And then once again, concerning the mix or the melange, you have a lot of self-explanatory elements in the book, and characters who explain themselves, so to speak. We find a metaphor at the very first pages of the book. It reminds us of a theater play which is about to begin, but the curtain has not been opened. Now push the theater stick 3 times so that people know the theater play will begin in a minute. That's what the French call the regisseur. That's what the regisseur does. So you hear the sound, knock, 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 and then it begins. So that's the beginning of the novel here. The sound, and then it will begin. And then there are descriptions of the costumes and of the hall, the stage. And then the economic leaders or the business leaders enter the stage. And then the ego, the I, is being introduced. The author appears. And then we appear. And then he says, and now the characters, and now my figures. So he introduces himself, the author, the director, or the regisseur in that case, and then we follow, and then we see the play. It's described in detail. What about this theatrical metaphor? Is it important for him? Well, I wouldn't interpret it that way. The I is clearly intentional, because nothing is ever innocent, and there is no innocent narrator, and you never have the innocent, the neutral person who tells the story, not even in a classical context, so to speak, as far as the theater is concerned. Now, of course, when I translated the book, I realized that this is also about theater language. And then I saw the turning stage and the situation in which you see what happens on stage, and then the stage turns and you see what happens backstage, so to speak, and all this is part of an enactment, and you never know whether you are in the audience or on stage, in spite of knowing that you are the audience. And then of course I tried to find out, where do I find the turning stage? And then I realized it's the epic theater. Of course, I mean, there is a theater person here, but the assembly of documentary materials and ornaments or decorative scenes, and also this educational teaching language, I mean, that reminds me of Brecht, also as far as his narrative understanding is concerned. Just a few days ago, I read an article in which Vuillard says, you find a lot of fiction also in the memoirs of politicians, because a lot of it is being enacted ex post. And you find even more fiction than in Brecht's theaters. So I think the educational, theatrical approach of Brecht is also to be found in this book. However, Vuillard never said so. Well, that's certainly an interesting aspect. I read it and I asked myself, well, is it just vanity? I mean, is it about the ego of the writer who wants to be present in his book? But then I realized this is about multifunctionality, so to speak. There are a number of operations which are being undertaken here. And this is also about the enactment of the Nazi time. I mean, the scene we see at the beginning of the book, the tanks, which cannot move on because of the failed engines. And then Hitler drives by and people are waiting in the streets. And it's very difficult to imagine such a situation because the German images we have in mind are put on stage by Leni Riefenstahl and Goebbels. So you never see failing tanks which cannot go on, tanks in the dusty streets, which are kaput. So we do have theatrical means, and the author shows those means. They are evident. And he says, righto, I will tell you a story. I'm enacting, and I know that I am enacting. I'm telling a story, but you cannot attack me. But then it enhances my credibility. Because this novel, this recit, this essay, this report is about credibility too. And it's also about shaking what we consider a given, the dominant narrative, so to speak. With respect to the powerful dominance of the Nazis, for example, we do have a clear idea in mind, and he chooses those tipping scenes, so to speak, scenes in which there is always someone who does not say no, or who agrees to something which might not work, where there is no invitation to invade.
He's of course a great reader, and he says this always comes into being when you read it. You read memoirs by politicians, Halifax, Lord Halifax, Churchill, Schuschnigg, they were all important sources. And while reading, he always comes across dissonant elements, something which doesn't quite fit, something which puts a kind of spanner in the works. And he says, you can't really present it the way that it's been presented. And on that basis, he then reconstructs these scenes. And he also rounds off these scenes. There is this eye, which runs a risk. He writes himself, in a sense, into the narrative as an author who can be criticised, who's in a sense vouching for what is being stated and saying, well, no, I don't look at this the way that you do. So he turns the reader into a kind of co-author. That's the Brechtian effect. There's a kind of disruption. You show the means whereby you produce the fiction, and that also turns the reader into a co-author. And that means that you give the reader an opportunity to establish critical distance and thus to critically appraise the situation. Yes, there's this kind of enlightenment touch to it, almost an instructive element. And the notion of a récit, an account or a narration, when it comes to transposing this into German, it's quite striking because there's no indication of the sources. And the first thing I did when I got the book was to look at the back to see, well, did he actually say that, and where did he say that, and where is it recorded? But there's no actual bibliography with footnotes and so on. He quite clearly doesn't disclose his sources. That's part of the method. But all of the verbatim quotes are original quotes. You can track them down. Hitler, Goering, Ribbentrop, the telephone conversation, for example, they were recorded in the Nuremberg trials, just by way of example. So all of the direct quotes are indeed from historical sources, but the sources are not indicated. And he has this structure of original quotes, and on those, he then inserts the scenes which he has imagined. There was a lengthy discussion with the publishing house where we were talking about the question of whether this is an account or a narrative. The readers actually wanted a quote for every single tiny citation. I knew what he would say, and I realised that he would say no, no, no. But of course, I collected all of the sources because I had to actually identify those. But I did that to keep the publishing house happy, but we weren't to publish it. It's the closed form of the book, and the historical sources are something else. We had to reach an agreement with the author on that. And I think in essence it works very well. Well, yes, that's another stroke of genius, isn't it? You have to come to terms with that. And you have to trust the narrative voice, the narrative eye. And there's quite striking and original tone as well in the text. Of course, back then they spoke very differently, very coarse, unbelievably coarse, and lacking shame. I'd never have translated it like that, to be honest. I'd never have been so brutal. And that's also not present in the French translation of these quotes. We discussed this afternoon with the reading group in Berghof. Hitler says, I'm not going to change a single stroke of that. That's what's said in every single sentence. He used a very unusual German term, Beistrich. And of course, that's a real gift to the translator, because it gives you an interesting twist. You wouldn't necessarily come up with that yourself as a translator, but it gives a very different tonality. And it gives a very different sense of the actual era. And it also is much more forceful. And there's also this authorial eye figure, which is very striking. That makes the historical figures smaller. I was a bit sceptical about that initially, as to whether this was correct, whether it's an impudent French way of proceeding, of dealing with German history, making these historical figures smaller. That has a paradoxical effect. If it's not so enormous and powerful, then it would have been possible to stop this enormous apparatus with a little more courage. And that's a staging which could have been identified just as a stage. Yes, that makes it threatening as well. They're really, in a sense, almost acting out burlesque theatre, the banality of evil. And that makes it also easier to generalise as well. There's the German historiography is one thing. We tend to demonise these figures. But that also means that we put them onto the level of something extraordinary. Whereas he brings them all down to a certain level. They're lamentable figures, but at the same time it becomes clear that this could happen at any moment once again. So it's a sense didactic, or at least instructive, one could say. On the notion of the spectacle, there's a chapter in the middle which I think you were going to read to us, were you not? We still have time? Yes, just about. Yes, the prop store. I'm going to start in French. And it's important to know as well. Well, you can see it.
La vérité est dispersée dans toutes sortes de poussières. Ainsi, bien avant de se faire appeler Anders, autre, l'intellectuel allemand Günther Stern, émigré aux États-Unis, pauvre, juif, contraint de gagner une vie de petit boulot, devenu accessoiriste à plus de 40 ans, travaille à l'Hollywood Custom Palace, dont les galeries recèlent tout le passé vestimentaire de l'homme. C'est que l'Hollywood Custom Palace est un loueur de costumes. Il loue au cinéma les habits de Cléopâtre ou de Danton, ceux des jongleurs du Moyen-Âge ou des bourgeois de Calais. On trouve tout à l'Hollywood Palace, toute la défroque de l'humanité, néant sublime, miettes de gloire dispersées sur les rayonnages, simulacres de souvenirs. Ici, on tient en réserve les épées de bois, les couronnes de carton, les cloisons de papier. Tout est faux. Le charbon sur le col du mineur, l'usure aux genoux du mendiant, le sang au cou du condamné. L'histoire est un spectacle. À l'Hollywood Palace, on croise tout ce qui a été. Les vêtements des martyrs sont étendus et sèches sur les mêmes fils que les toges des patrices. On ne distingue pas. Il paraît que les images, le cinéma, les photographies, ce n'est pas le monde. Je n'en suis pas très sûre. Ainsi, les étages du bâtiment, où les époques s'amoncellent, laissent une impression d'absurde ou de folie. Comme si on était au cœur de la grandeur, mais coincé, rapetissé, que la poussière n'était que poudre, l'usure, illusion, la saleté, maquillage, et l'apparence, la vérité des choses. Mais toute l'humanité, c'est décidément trop. Et l'Hollywood Palace empile trop de défroques, amasse trop de variantes, accumule trop d'époques. On y trouve le drapé romain du péplum, l'égyptien de pacotille, le babylonien de cirque, le grec de contrebande. Mais aussi toutes les variantes du pagne et du pario, le sari coloré des femmes du Gujarat, le riche paluchari du Bengale, le coton léger de Pondichéry. On y déniche encore tous les sarongs malais, les vêtements à enfiler, ponchos, huques, pénulets, les premiers costumes à manches, tuniques, blouses et chemises, le caftan, la peau de bête de la préhistoire et tous les ancêtres des pantalons. C'est une caverne merveilleuse, l'Hollywood Palace. Certes, le travail n'y est pas très reluisant. Plier les vêtements du cadavre de Pancho Villa, ajuster la collerette de Marie Stuart, remettre le chapeau de Napoléon sur son étagère. Mais quel privilège tout de même, être un accessoiriste de l'histoire. Günther Stern betont es in seinen Tagebüchern ausdrücklich. Es gibt dort alle Kleider. Selbst solche, die von Zirkusaffen oder den kleinen Hunden aus Deauville getragen wurden. Einfach alles. Von Adams Feigenblatt bis zu den Stiefeln der SA. Das Erstaunlichste daran ist jedoch nicht, dass dort alle Kostüme der Erde zu finden sind, sondern hier und jetzt bereits die Kostüme der Nazis. Und, wie Günther Stern anmerkt, besteht die Ironie des Ganzen darin, dass ihnen ein Jude die Stiefel poliert. Schließlich muss der ganze Plunder ja auf Vordermann gebracht werden. Wie jeder andere Angestellte des Hollywood Custom Palace muss Günther Stern die Stiefel der Nazis mit der gleichen Sorgfalt polieren, mit der er die Kothurne der Gladiatoren oder die Sandalen der Chinesen bürstet. Hier ist die wirkliche Tragödie fehl am Platz. Die Kostüme müssen fertig sein für die Dreharbeiten, für die große Inszenierung der Welt. Und sie werden fertig sein. Sogar originalgetreuer als die echten Stücke, detailreicher als die Museumsexemplare. Perfekte Repliken, an denen nicht ein Knopf fehlt, kein Fädchen und die wie in den Regalen der Geschäfte für jeden Körperbau existieren. Diese Kleider sollen jedoch nicht nur untadelige Repliken, sondern außerdem auch schäbig, löchrig und dreckig sein. Genau, die Welt ist schließlich keine Modenschau und das Kino muss die Illusion aufrechterhalten. Es gilt also, falsche Sprünge, falsche Flecken und falschen Grünspan zu pflegen. Es soll der Eindruck entstehen, dass die Zeit ihre Spuren hinterlassen hat. Lange vor der Schlacht um Stalingrad, lange bevor das Unternehmen Barbarossa geplant, durchdacht und beschlossen war, vor dem Frankreich-Feldzug, ja noch bevor die Deutschen ihn überhaupt ins Auge gefasst hatten, herrschte in den Regalen des Spektakels schon Krieg. Die große amerikanische Maschine schien sich bereits eines ungeheuren Aufruhrs bemächtigt zu haben. Sie sollte den Krieg ausschließlich als Heldentat darstellen. Sie sollte ihn in ein Einkommen ummünzen, in ein Thema, ein gutes Geschäft. Letzten Endes sind es weder die Panzer noch die Stukas noch die Stalinorgeln, welche die Dinge erneuern, umformen und zerknittern. Nein, dort drüben im emsigen Kalifornien zwischen ein paar abgezirkelten Boulevards an einer Kreuzung zwischen Donut und Tanksäule bekommt die Dichte unseres Lebens den Ton kollektiver Gewissheiten. Dort drüben, in den ersten Supermärkten, vor den ersten Fernsehgeräten, zwischen Toaster und Taschenrechner, enthüllt sich die Welt in ihrem wahren Rhythmus, dem sie schlussendlich verfallen sollte. Während der Führer noch seinen Angriff auf Frankreich vorbereitete, während sein Generalstab abermals Schlieffens alte Formeln wiederkäute und seine Mechaniker ihre Panzer reparierten, hatte Hollywood bereits all ihre Kostüme in die Regale der Vergangenheit geräumt. Sie hingen auf den Bügeln der ad acta gelegten Angelegenheiten, gefaltet und gestapelt in der Abteilung für altes Zeug. Ja, lange bevor der Krieg überhaupt begann, während Lebrun blind und taub seine Dekrete zur Lotterie verabschiedete, während Halifax sich kameradschaftlich gab und das entrückte österreichische Volk in der Silhouette eines Verrückten sein Schicksal zu erkennen meinte, waren die Nazi-Kostüme im Requisitenlager bereits konserviert.
Danke. Wir nähern uns dem Ende.
We're drawing to the end, almost, of this discussion. But there's one thing I would like to ask. I'm very interested to know if the book's reception in Germany and France is different. Is it read differently in the two countries? After all, you live in France. You've produced the German translation. Has there been a book tour yet? You've got perhaps some idea of how it's been received by the audience, by critics in Germany, and perhaps also in Germany. Maybe you can say a few words about the reception in Germany and France. This book came out last May, and it was very successful over the summer as well. 30,000 copies sold, I believe, and then it was nominated for the Prix Goncourt, and then it really snowballed. At first, of course, the question was really whether this book really deserved the Prix Goncourt, and there was some debate about that amongst the jury because it's actually not a novel per se. It's the category of a récit, an account, a narration. I think in Germany there was much more of a focus as to why this topic was addressed now. Because the other major French prize also addressed the Third Reich era and addressed Mengele. That wasn't such a big issue in France. And is it read as a parable of the collapse of democracy in France? Well, yes, certainly it is read in that spirit as well. Now, as far as I know, it's had very good reviews in Germany. And certainly in terms of the word of mouth that I've heard from people I know who've read it, it's had a very good reaction. I've given it to lots of people and told them to read it at once. It, of course, disrupts our perception of history. This dramatic narrative that we have, that this whole process couldn't be stopped. There was 19th century militarism, there was anti-Semitism, nobody could stop the Nazis coming. That's the traditional narrative. But this book pierces through that traditional narrative, making everybody share the responsibility and the guilt, but at the same time shedding light on the actual responsibility and where that lies, because every individual in that historical situation could have said yes or no. There are countless moments in which people agreed, consented, did not resist, just went along with the flow, or didn't defend others. And from that point of view, and that I think is why it's a very powerful book in the current situation we have in Germany, because it talks about the scope for action of the individual. What I find striking in the German reception is that all the reviews have failed to talk about the last chapter. Nobody addresses the last chapter. They go from 1933 to 38, but no, actually, this book ends in 58 with an extremely brutal scene. An extremely horrific scene, and that's quite remarkable. I believe that is the author's method. We talked about the notion of the spectacle, the notion of a light handedness, a light white touch, and making the figures small again, but then we come to compensation, reparation payments paid to Jewish forced laborers, the son of Gustav Krupp and Alfred Krupp, being really stingy. The very first time in the entire book we hear somebody saying no, no in democracy, the business leaders can finally say no, and they say no vis-a-vis reparations to the Jewish forced laborers who they exploited and enabled them to continue. So the book continues seamlessly engaging with the second guilt, the fact that in the 1950s in young, fledgling West Germany, there wasn't an appropriate response to what had happened. And that's also very interesting if you look at the metaphor of the theatre play as well, which continues until the end. In 1944, Krupp sees all of the corpses. It picks up on the Macbeth scene as well, the banquet scene, the coronation. He's murdered the king and he's taken power, and as it's to be celebrated, there he is with the whole court and the queen. He is the only one who sees all of the corpses which he has caused, paving his way. He sees Banco, and Gustav Krupp sees the dead slave laborers of his concentration camp, but Alfred Krupp doesn't see those dead people and therefore does not draw the lessons from it. I'm afraid we have to wind up, sadly, although it's so interesting. So definitely, don't forget, this book isn't just fantastic and well composed, but it's also important, and you have to read it. Read it, give it to your friends, lend it to your friends. It really needs to be read. It's a work of art, and it's a necessary work of art. Thank you.